Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for inviting us to hold oral arguments here at Liberty High School. We really appreciate it. We just got a new building downtown. It's beautiful, where the Nevada Supreme Court and the Nevada Court of Appeals will now be housed from now on. It's just not quite done. We're having the grand opening next week. So we really, really appreciate all of you accommodating us. And I just want to give a shout out to my first cousin right there, the dean of your school, Preston Gora. Yay! Did you guys know that coming in?
No.
All right, there's the smart one.
So anyway, without further ado, we're going to have two cases today presented to you, and we'll call the first one, which is case number 69962, Potts versus State. If you would, attorneys for the record, because this is being recorded, if you can all state, although we certainly know all the attorneys, if you could all state your name for the record.
Lester Price for Mr. Potts.
All right. And although you didn't file a reply brief, is it your intention to want or request rebuttal time?
Yes, Your Honor.
How much rebuttal time would you like?
5 minutes, Your Honor.
All right, that will be the order. Thank you so much. Go ahead and proceed whenever you're ready.
Do I have to press a button or?
No.
Thank you for hearing our case. People often ask me why I became a criminal defense lawyer of all the professions. And the reason I always give them is because if we don't get the criminal law right, then we really can't get anything right. And nothing else matters. All the politics, all the news, none of that matters is if you can be accused and convicted of a crime you didn't commit, or convicted of a crime where the state didn't prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's what we have here in this case. A brief rendition of the facts are as follows. According to the accuser, he went to Mr. Langley, went to the bank to get money for rent. He had a rent that was due on March 3rd, and that was the day of this event. So he goes to the bank to get the money. He comes back. He allegedly meets my client and is allegedly a victim of larceny from the person. What he said was that my client offered him a cigarette, and while he was grabbing the cigarette, my client reached around and grabbed the wallet sticking out of his back pocket, opened it up, took cash out, laid it on the ground, and ran away. That's the basic statement of the facts, but at trial, a lot more than that came out. So he has, to understand Mr. Langley's testimony, we have to go to who he is. Mr. Langley is a diagnosed bipolar disorder. He was getting Social Security benefits. He was taking medicine for bipolar. He takes it at the morning and the night. And he needs his medication to function properly. Now, he testified that on the day of this incident, he didn't have his medication because his roommate had been withholding it from him for 1 or 2 weeks. And at trial, he testified that he wasn't taking any medications. And then, later on, he said, I'm not testifying anymore unless I can take a break to get my medication. So the difficulty in this trial was the accuser couldn't really remember one 10-second interval from the next 10-second interval. So if I tried to impeach him with some inconsistent statements, he just wouldn't remember what he had said from 10 minutes to the next 10 minutes. And so I laid out in my brief some of the coaching that appeared to have happened. When 911 was called, because his position was that he did not call 911, he does not know who called 911, he doesn't know who handed him the phone with his voice on it from the 911 tape, and I believe that was the 911 tape was transmitted to your honors. There's a voice in the background who James Langley identifies as his roommate, Brad. And Brad is coaching him, giving him the descriptors. Here's what he looks like. Here's how tall he is. Here's all these things, and here's his phone number. So Brad coaches him through that. That's on the 911 tape. At trial, he also testified that the state helps him out because he gets confused and doesn't have medication. So when the state tried to clear that up and say, hey, what did I tell you to do? He said, he said to sit there. He basically said to sit there and listen to her preaching and not say anything that deviated from what he told her to say. Actually, I think his words were, "You told me to keep my mouth shut and go by your preaching." So he's very clearly mentally challenged. And that's all, you know, fine. But the problem was this case was not corroborated by any other testimony. There's no other witnesses that allegedly saw this happen. There's nobody else that can bear on what the timing was of everything that happened. So,
well, the victim in this case had the defendant over his apartment for 2 hours. The two met the next day, and the victim identified him in court at a preliminary hearing and at trial again. So it's not really a case involving a stranger identification at night for only a few quick seconds. So my question to you is, assuming this court agrees with you that somehow the police lineup was unnecessarily suggestive or should have been suppressed as far as evidence from the jury, why wouldn't that be harmless error in this case?
Your Honor, there
is a citation here, actually,
to a case. And the law is that the court will not overturn or disturb a verdict if substantial evidence supports a conviction. That's LaPierre versus State, 108 Nevada 528. In that case, they vacated the conviction. And the issue here, Your Honors, is that there is nothing else that corroborates what happened. There's nothing else. And his testimony was so inconsistent that no rational jury could have found my client guilty beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well, his mental ability or his medical condition comes into play one of two ways, right? And it seems to me you're not saying that he's not competent to testify or not competent to render proper identification, right? And therefore, you're not saying his testimony wasn't admissible. So doesn't it come down to you're saying his testimony is not believable? And isn't that a jury question?
Your Honor, what it comes down to is that his testimony that is not a jury question, Your Honor. I mean, certainly, the jury gets to weigh credibility. But if an accuser says 1 minute is day, the next minute is night, it took 4 hours for this to happen, it took 1 hour for this to happen, I was off my medication, at some point, we have to broaden our scope of what we look at, the testimony of the victim. And could a rational jury find this proven beyond a reasonable doubt, given the entirety of the testimony? He's saying he's getting coached by the state. He's saying he got coached by Brad. He's saying he got coached by the police. Certainly, if we just narrow our focus to, did the accuser identify the defendant? Did he state the basic nature of the claim against the defendant? And did he say this all happened in Clark County? Then certainly, the state would have met their burden. But, of course, that would render an appeal totally worthless. If that's all they have to say, just the magic words, that's him, he took my money, and it's happened in Clark County, then there really is no reason to have a sufficiency of the evidence argument. But it's well-settled case law that you can have a sufficiency of the evidence argument. In this case, he testified so differently. He presented a receipt that showed he arrived at the bank at 10:04. The 911 tape says it's 10:45 when the 911 tape was taken. Now, he testified that that day he took the bus or he walked. He doesn't remember. But that he waited at least an hour to take the bus back to his apartment. And he talked to my client for a number of minutes. And he went looking for my client after the money was taken for another hour. And he testified that at the end of this, it was about 3 or 4 p.m. Well, that clearly goes against what the 911 tape says. Now, is the jury allowed to disregard all of the things that cut against the state's evidence, argument of credibility, and just focus in on these allegations? I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that is why we have an appeals court, to really make sure that they did their job and they weren't distracted by other issues. And some other issues did come up. In jury selection, there was jury number 57. I was talking to jury number 69 and asking him, hey, can you follow the law? And he basically said, well, if the law means that I get to convict him if he's not innocent, then yeah. And juror number 57 chimed in. That was Tony Trump. He said, he just spontaneously said, he looks guilty. And I was kind of taken aback. And I go, I'm sorry. He goes, he looks guilty. And I go, you think he looks guilty? What makes you say that? I mean, he just looks guilty. But that doesn't mean he's guilty. Okay. He looks guilty because he's kind of afraid, you know, try to look cool, but he's not. And that's all I can say. I mean, he just looks guilty. And so that was one of the problems.
Did you keep him on that jury?
No, Your Honor. He was not on the jury. But that was one of the challenges that you face, is that when you come to court and you sit in that defendant's seat, you look guilty every time. It doesn't matter who you are. And my client, you know, he was a younger man, he had a shaved head, he was a thinner build, and so I think the jury probably, in my view, just said, you know what, if he's not good for this one, he's good for another one, and therefore we're going to find him guilty. There was a great number of inconsistencies in this matter. The timeline alone just doesn't even add up anywhere near to what it should. But he also said that the detectives helped him identify this person, that they told him what the name was when they arrived, that they circled the photo on the photo identification lineup. Certainly, that has to go, that's the quintessential suggestive lineup. I mean, that's not even in question. If that's what he did, and that's, if the jury has said, no, I don't find him credible when he's talking about the police, but I find him credible when he's talking about the defendant, then we have a big issue here. And so, the problems with this testimony were manifold. He definitely agreed that none of the photos in the lineup looked anything like my client. And that was, I mean, certainly he's got the hair color, maybe, and the race correct. But I would encourage your honors to look at the photo lineup because it is really important. I did ask that it be transmitted, and it wasn't transmitted. I think that will clear up part of why I said this photo lineup.
So well, the problem is it wasn't transmitted. You did file a supplemental brief, so we don't actually have the photo lineup.
And my understanding is your honors can order that after this oral argument. I did move to have it transmitted. The court denied my motion, but it can be, the court can revisit that after the argument if it
you have it. 5 minutes right now.
Remaining or for
yes,
rebuttal?
Yes, remaining for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. I would ask the attorneys to keep your voices up. We have a lot of background sound. So keep your voices up so the students here can hear you. Thanks.
May it please the court, I'm Steve Owens of the Clark County District Attorney's Office here on behalf of the respondent in this matter, the State of Nevada. This case, it is important that we get it right. That's what opposing counsel said in criminal cases, we need to get it right. But when it comes to questions of fact, and that's all that I heard from opposing counsel is disputes of fact, that is the role of the jury, to be the fact finder. The Court of Appeals' role is to rule on questions of law. To the extent that there were inconsistencies in the testimony below, to the extent that the victim in this case, who was bipolar and had certainly some mental challenges, to the extent that he was believable, that's the function of the jury to decide that. The victim's not here. I can't put him in front of you and have you make your own assessment of whether or not he was believable on the witness stand. The jurors, though, that was their job. They got to listen firsthand to that victim. They got to listen to the questioning by this defense attorney. And incidentally, when you have somebody who's mentally challenged and you're questioning them on the stand, you need to proceed in a little bit different manner than with an adult. You'd have to proceed the same way that you would with a child witness or perhaps an elderly witness who is having their mental faculties maybe declining a little bit. I agree with Judge Tao that I don't see the issue here being one of witness competence. That would be a different line of cases. I don't see that they're challenging and saying as a matter of law that this witness was so incompetent that he could not, as a matter of law, take the stand and testify. And so he did witness, he did perceive an event, and he recounted it to the best of his ability. Certainly the defense attorney was able to trip him up on the witness stand and ask him questions and box him in and get him to recite things a little bit inconsistently.
In the record it appeared that there was some contradictory testimony. He took the stand and he first said he wasn't on lithium, and then he changed it to, well, he had taken lithium, which is extremely, it's a very serious drug prior to his testimony, but he flip-flopped on that. So explain to this court why on appeal we should uphold a conviction for larceny from the person. It's such a serious crime based on a witness who's taking lithium, not taking lithium, been diagnosed bipolar, schizophrenic.
Well, I can't speak for the jury to know exactly how they resolved that, but they did resolve it in the state's favor, and this court has viewed the facts in the light most favorable to the state for that very reason. But just looking at those, that testimony in context, the way that I read it was that when defense counsel first asked him whether or not you're on any medications currently, it was in the context of sleeping medication. The conversation that occurred right before then was whether or not he needed medication to sleep. And in that, I think that's what the victim was indicating when he said, well, I'm not on any sleeping medication today. I think that's what the victim intended to say. And then within just a couple of sentences later, he does admit, oh, yes, I am bipolar, and I am on lithium. I do take my lithium. So some of the perceived inconsistencies, I think when it comes right down to it, are not inconsistencies. It's just an inability of the witness to be able to communicate precisely like an attorney would ask in questioning. Likewise, I think
Mr. Paredes also argued not only inconsistencies, but lack of cooperation. Is there any legal requirement to have other evidence corroborate this type of witness? We know the general rule is there's not a requirement of cooperation. The most typical case is the sexual assault one. But is it different in this situation because the person was mentally challenged?
There's no rule of law that says that a victim who has a mental illness needs to be corroborated in some way as a matter of law. Now, factually, a jury might want some corroboration in order to reach that proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Some witnesses who are mentally ill might testify in a manner that we don't reach that standard with the jury, but this jury did believe this witness beyond a reasonable doubt. The law requires no further corroboration.
Was there other cooperation type of evidence, such as evidence that he went to the bank, he withdrew a certain amount of money, his wallet was empty when the police got there, he would have used that money to pay for his rent, a series of events that would show that, oh yeah, the money's gone, and the only issue in this case then is that the person that did it.
Yes, he did go to the bank. We had the receipt that the jury could view, and we had the detective who was there for the photographic lineup who said the victim pointed at that photograph, the victim circled that photograph and picked out this defendant consistently at the photo lineup, at the preliminary hearing, and at the trial. So there was some corroboration for the jury. It's just not legally required under the law. And so for the sufficiency of the evidence claim here, I think you have to resolve those inconsistencies in the state's favor. There's explanations for them. I don't agree that there's anything in the record that says that where the victim claims that the photograph was circled for him by a detective. I think that's an incomplete sentence that I went and looked at in there, and it could be read a couple different ways, and certainly it was clarified when it comes back around the cross-examination. We clarified to both the victim and the detective that it was the victim who circled that photograph. So we got the testimony of the victim and the detective, both of whom say the victim circled the photograph. There was nothing suggestive about that lineup procedure. I didn't hear anything about the timeliness of the motion, but that was a big deal below because they filed this, they don't even file it, they originally moved to suppress the photo identification at the beginning of trial. That's a motion that's supposed to be made 15 days before trial. So that there can be perhaps an evidentiary hearing, so that there can be briefing on it. The judge below didn't have the benefit of all that. He says, I'm finding your motion is untimely. You haven't done what you're supposed to. You can't raise it now. And so that's going to hamper this court's ability to review the issue somewhat. Certainly you can still review constitutional challenges, and that's what they're alleging here. But the record is not as good as it should have been had there been an evidentiary hearing before trial on this very issue. In preparing for argument,
didn't the judge also say that even if it was timely, I've looked at it and it's not suggested?
That's where I was going next. I'm not sure that we highlighted that in our brief, but I certainly did find that, because the judge said, I'm finding that it's untimely, however, I'll allow you to make the argument when it comes time during the testimony. And they did raise the argument, and there was a discussion, and at volume 2, page 346, the judge says, the question is it unnecessarily suggestive? And my determination here looking at this is that it is not. So the judge ultimately did reach that question. He looked at the photo lineup that the Court of Appeals here does not have before it.
So he made that factual determination on the record after he himself reviewed it as well?
Yes, he looked at it. And now I know they asked the victim on the stand, those people in the lineup, they don't look anything alike, right? They were able to lead that victim along, and the victim said, yeah, they don't look anything like that guy. So sure he was in his identification. That's the testimony that they're relying on. But the judge below, who in this situation is the fact finder, looked at that photograph, looked at all the photos of the various suspects and said there's nothing unnecessarily suggestive about this. The background all looks the same. There's nothing that singles out the defendant from the others and suggests to the viewer, to the witness, of who's the right person to select, like the police are somehow prompting or leading the witness to select the defendant's photo. That's a fact finding this court must defer to.
Did you see it, the lineup?
I haven't seen the lineup because they didn't put it into the record on appeal. This court declined to transmit it and said it can be reproduced in an appendix. And to my knowledge, they never reproduced it in an appendix. So I have not seen it. I didn't do the trial in this. And so I only looked at the record on appeal. And
that's not your bell. I think that's a school bell.
Okay.
You can keep going.
I still got time. And so I think that's a finding that this court needs to defer to and uphold, because there's no evidence of the contrary. This was not a suggestive lineup. And if it's not suggestive, that means there's no state action, there's no misconduct by the police. We don't even reach the reliability prong. And so this court would need to hold that there was no due process violation in the admission of this photo lineup identification by the witness. And the second issue is the sufficiency of the evidence. I haven't heard anything here that really is an issue this court can sink its teeth into in terms of why you can't affirm the sufficiency of the evidence. You look at the light most favorable to the state. Are there sufficient facts from which a reasonable juror could have found all the elements beyond a reasonable doubt? Even if the witness is inconsistent about some of these other peripheral details, you have to focus on the elements. We don't have to prove up everything that happened beyond a reasonable doubt. Did he take a bus or did he walk? The elements of the crime are that they were taken from the person of another without their consent. And certainly the victim was unequivocal that the defendant was the person who did that. Reached into his pocket, took out his wallet, took money out of the wallet, left the wallet on the ground, and took off laughing. And this was somebody that was known to the victim, who he had met the day before. He was sure and confident in his identifications every step along the way. Those elements were all proven by facts beyond a reasonable doubt. There's no dispute or inconsistency about any of those facts. To the extent there were other disputes, that you have to leave to the fact finder, to the jury in this case. So I encourage the court to affirm.
What do you think then, Mr. Owens, on the identification? This case, I bet you were surprised to see that was the primary argument on appeal, because it typically is a jury question. There are lots of cases, though, where the identification is a very close call. Do you see this one as anywhere near that?
Well, as Judge Silver said, this was not a stranger ID. This was somebody known to the victim. And so I think the idea in this case was pretty strong. I have seen identifications in other cases where a witness in the heat of the moment gets a very limited glimpse at a stranger suspect, someone that they don't have any pre-existing knowledge of. And yeah, sometimes they can have a difficult time recognizing them in a photo lineup. They're not always as confident and as sure as this victim was in this case. There are issues that can be presented with eyewitness accounts failing to match up with the evidence in the case. We just don't have any of that here in this particular case.
And was there evidence that the defendant knew that the victim would be going to the bank and withdrawing this money so he could arrange to be at the right place at the right time to lift the wallet?
Yes. That's the conversation the victim and the defendant had the day before. He gets his paycheck on the first Thursday of the month, which was going to be the next day. I'm going to the bank. I'm going to get my Social Security disability money. And the victim is, or the defendant is like, here's a great, easy target. That's why victims of crime are easily preyed upon when they're vulnerable people.
Was there any testimony by a crime scene analyst that they tried to obtain fingerprints off of the wallet or anywhere he sat in the house the day before to corroborate what the victim said here?
I don't believe there was. I don't think there was, that the parties felt there was any need for corroboration legally, and with the volume of cases, many of these cases often negotiate out, and we don't know which are going to trial and which we should really gear up for a full bore. But I didn't read any testimony about that. Thank you. If there's no further questions, I'll conclude my comments then.
Maybe you could just briefly explain for the benefit of the students the difference between a photographic lineup and a live lineup.
Well, a live lineup is live people down usually in the jail where they were behind a plate of glass, one-way glass. They'll bring in various suspects from the facility and put the defendant somewhere in that lineup, and on the other side of the glass, the witness comes in and is asked to make an identification, so you get the benefit of seeing an actual live person, and they turn, and on occasion, you can even have them speak certain words if that was the identifying characteristic that would be the basis of the victim's ID.
Do the police actually use those, or is it just photographic lineups because they're a lot simpler?
They do. They do both. Here, the line, photo lineup, I think, is usually used when we don't have the suspect already in custody. And here, he was not in custody, and so they go grab photographs of various individuals that all look similar to the suspect and see if the victim can point out.
Is there any merit to an argument that, you know, when a defendant is sitting there at a preliminary hearing and they're the only person there at the preliminary hearing, and that mentally challenged victim, he's in the stand, they ask him to identify who took his money out of his wallet, and there's only one person sitting there at the defense table. Is there any merit to the claim that this is unnecessarily suggestive as far as identification by that victim?
Something like that might be obvious to someone like you and me, familiar with this justice system, but a preliminary hearing often has as many people as we have in this courtroom right here, and if you look around, there's people sitting all over the place. So yes, a mentally ill person or victim in this case looked around the courtroom at preliminary hearing and said, yeah, I don't see him here. I would know him right away. And then he says, oh, there he is. He's right there. Almost like a surprise. It took him a minute to look around and carefully look at everyone seated in the courtroom. So that, to me, suggests it is reliable. But it wasn't so suggestive that he could figure out immediately who it was. He had to look. And I've had that happen not just with someone who's a little bit mentally challenged. I've had that happen with perfectly competent witnesses in the stress of a courtroom and so many people, they don't always see the suspect that they identified previously sitting right there at counsel table in front of them.
All right, thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So, Dennis, I want to draw your attention to my opening brief at page 9 because it talks about the suggestiveness of the photo lineup. And reading from the quote, I was asking Mr. Langley about how he selected my client. And he says, I say, did he then show you the second page? He goes, yes, he did. They had me pick him out when he is in here. And somebody else circled him. I signed it. I signed my name right underneath him. And so I think that undercuts the state's argument that nobody suggested to him who this person was. The other issue is, although the court is under the impression that Mr. Langley knew Mr. Potts, when you listen to the 911 tape, he didn't know his name, he didn't know his phone number, and the descriptors were not known by Mr. Langley. They were fed to him by the voice on the phone, which can be clearly heard in the 911 tape. As far as corroboration, yes, he did go to the bank. It appears he did withdraw money at 10:04. However, there's a 911 tape at 10:45, and he is saying that he finished his conversation with Mr. Potts, my client, at 3 or 4 p.m. The other issue, to go back a little bit, is that the rent, according to him, was due on the 3rd. According to him, is paid by money order. According to him, he normally gets it at the Albertsons. And that day, he was going to pay rent. Not sure why he didn't get the money order at Albertsons, but he testified, that he got two money orders that day and put it in his wallet. And therefore, at page 423 of my appendix, he had $1,019 minus $750. That would put the money, number one, that wouldn't be $1,019 if my client was charged, but that would also be a big discrepancy between how much money was taken and what was in his wallet that was taken.
How much money is also a factual scenario for the jury.
Sure, Your Honor. And let's get back to that, because that is an important point. If I come in and say, yeah, we're all there was Big Bird and Elmo, and there was Obi-Wan Kenobi, and then I saw Judge Silver steal, a box of pens, Sure. They've made out the case, but the problem is the jury can't just disregard Elmo and Obi-Wan Kenobi and all the other fictitious people and focus in on Your Honor or anybody for that matter. And that's why, yes, it is a jury question, but there has to be some, yes, some minimal threshold of credibility. And although I didn't challenge his competency, you know, I think he knows right from wrong, and I think if I asked him what color my suit, he would say black. But he's somewhere in that hazy line where I don't know that I could get him found incompetent, but certainly his testimony was so contradictory between being able to identify my client, the timeline of the 911 call versus the withdrawal from the bank, you know, and obviously, look, at the trial and at the preliminary hearing, the only two people sitting at the defense counsel table are the client who's in shackles at the preliminary hearing and the lawyer. So that identification isn't really hard to make out. At the trial, same situation except he was wearing a shirt. He did look around at the trial and said, no, I don't see him, I don't see him, I don't see him. And then finally said, oh, there he is, right there. So he did do that, but my suggestion to Your Honors is that he has been coached from the very beginning of this case, from the time he made the 911 call, somebody is telling him what to say through the investigation, through the interview, and even up through trial. And that's the big problem here.
Mr. Crate, is it, we're sensitive to this issue of a misidentification. I mean, it happens. There's people on death row that were misidentified. But the point that the other judges were making was it was a known individual. So all he has to be able to recognize is his face. So even if he got every other detail wrong, if he could recognize his face, is that enough? Or are you saying that the process was tainted because of the final lineup, or because of the way it was done in the courtroom, or because of his mental problems? I mean, where is the flaw that breaks this, that makes this chain strong or broken?
I think the chain is broken cumulatively, but also when the detective points out to him who he is. And I know that we're saying he was known to him, but when he made that 911 call, he did not know who that person was. He didn't know his name, didn't know his phone number.
Those are all the details. When he saw him, say, oh, I recognize his face.
Certainly, Your Honor.
But was there something that happened before that that made that not reliable?
Go ahead, you may finish.
Yes, Your Honor, drawing your attention to page 304, lines 2 through 12, that certainly would account amount to misconduct, and I would say vitiate the photo lineup. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you so much. This case will now stand submitted.